Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Northern Idaho. Folks, today, before I begin my regular broadcast, I thought I'd bring you some musical entertainment. And this is a special kind of musical entertainment. This is an old World War II era recording in the English language by Charlie and His Orchestra, their rendition of the famous Jewish-American comic and singer Eddie Cantor's song, Making Whoopee. Now, I hope you will be able to understand some of the lyrics. They are singing with a German accent in the English language, and of course it's not the best recording, but I think you'll find those lyrics rather interesting. It is an adaptation, that is, of the song. So, that having been said, let's make some whoopee.
Have asked Eddie Cantor to write a new version of his famous old-timer, Making Whoopee. In one of his latest programs on the air, he sang the following song.
Another war, another prophet, another Jewish Christmas trick, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of dough, a lot of gold, the British Empire's being sold. We're in the money, thanks to Frankie, we're making whoopee. Washington is our ghetto, Roosevelt our king. Democracy is our motto, think what a war can bring. We throw our German names away. We are the kikes of USA. You are the boys, folks. We are the boys, folks. We're making whoopee.
I hear Mark Glenn in the back on the horn. This is Michael Collins Piper, and it is a beautiful day in Idaho. I am going to piss off a lot of our listeners today because I'm going to tell you that the United States did not win World War II. There's a lot of fine people who fought in World War II, and they like to think that they came back as victors. But no, the United States did not win World War II. In fact, I'm going to tell you right up front, It's a war that need not and should not have been fought. And if you think I'm wrong about that, my first advice to you is to just turn this program off. Don't listen. However, if you have any interest in the truth, or if you have any interest in listening to what other people think, then you might want to listen. It's all up to you. I don't care, frankly, because I have nothing to lose, folks. That's one of the great benefits of the position that I'm in. I have a failing heart. I can't walk. My career as a writer is basically over. And I have this god-awful opportunity to just say what I want about anybody and anything. And who's going to screw me? They can send me to federal prison and I'll get at least some half-decent health care. I get free housing. I get some food. I can't get that now. Can you believe that? I can't get that now. I've worked for all my life, but I can't get disability. Even though I'm crippled up and my heart's failing, I can't get disability. And these creepolas, Willis Cardo and his wife Elizabeth Cardo, who have run off and put millions of dollars into offshore accounts. The federal government's let them get away with it. Got to ask that question, why? They're able to get away with it, and their enablers, such as Pete Papaheracles, a student of the Church of Scientology, and the people that are under Pete Papaheracles' influence, they can get away with all this money, but poor old fat Mike Piper, who can barely walk, I can't even get disability. That should raise some questions. Think about that, folks. Let me do my imitation of Pete Papaheracles. Hey, boss. Hey, boss. Let's talk about the niggers and the Jews. Let's talk about the homosexuals. And then Willis comes back and says, "Yeah, Pete. Yeah, these fairies. I don't know what to do about them." "Hey, boss. I don't know. Yeah, let's think about that." Well, folks, who really won World War II? I want to talk to you today about the inside story of the Kennedy dynasty and the reality of Jewish power in America. Here we are in the 21st century, and the problem of anti-Semitism rages as much today as it ever did, perhaps even more so. Jews tell us that that anti-Semitism is just all over the place. But the fact is, we would not be where we are today were it not for the turbulent events of the century that came before. And when all is said and done, there will be no question that, at least in one definite respect, the Jews are absolutely right, and quote me on that. Adolf Hitler and National Socialist Germany and World War II, and yes, the Holocaust, will ultimately be considered central to our understanding of the 20th century and everything that's followed. So that's why, as I wrap up my life, and my life is coming to an end, thank God, because I do not want to spend the rest of my life in pain as I am in pain now, ladies and gentlemen. Terrible pain. That's why I want to take a deep historical digression and relate the fascinating story of a remarkable individual I was pleased to call a friend, and who, in a really unique way, played a secret and pivotal and actually rather bizarre role in shaping the direction of American and world history. Now, the story that I'm about to relate is very much a part of what can only be called hidden history. I've told parts of it before in other places and in other contexts. And, you know, in many respects, it's so extraordinarily inflammatory, and it is inflammatory, that it will both intrigue and outrage so many people, depending on their point of view, precisely because it says so much about how political affairs really do work behind the scenes. But you know, folks, more importantly, and this is the real point of all of this, it demonstrates indisputably that the Jewish presence and the problem of anti-Semitism is very much the root of the most controversial issues of our time. Money, power, war, and peace. Now, that having been said, I will note that over my many years in the American nationalist movement, which I suppose I'm now coming to regret, I made many good friends, some of whom remain my good friends. And I met some truly individual people, memorable people. But among them stands out one person in particular, the legendary DeWest Hooker. He was a long time behind the scenes figure in the nationalist movement, and he died at age 81 in Washington, D.C. on September 22nd, 1999. A lot of people don't like DeWest Hooker. And you know why they don't like DeWest Hooker? I'll tell you why. It's rather interesting. It says a lot about people. DeWest Hooker was a good-looking man. He was articulate. He was rich. He was funny. He knew a lot of important people. He was just like, I suppose, what a lot of people would like to be with. A lot of people who would like to be as one with DeWest Hooker. He was an interesting guy, any way you cut it. And so, because of the fact that he was one of these people, he's one of these people with a lot of money, good looks, entertaining. A lot of people don't like people like that. But that's the way West Hooker was. DeWest Hooker. Yes, that was his name. Hooker. H-O-O-K-E-R. Now, I have to tell you, I was first introduced to West Hooker in 1984 by Willis Cardo. And as much of a piece of garbage as Willis Cardo turned out to be, and I found that out a long time ago, folks, but I couldn't say it publicly because, well, let's face it, let's be honest, I was on Willis Cardo's payroll. I will always have to thank Willis Cardo for making that introduction. Because, you know, for along with Willis himself, have to acknowledge it, Wes Tucker became one of the foremost influences upon my own political and philosophical outlook. And as you'll see, West's own life experiences and his dynamic personality made him someone who was simply not to be ignored. And I miss him a lot. Now, it's really worth taking a look at West Tucker. A really interesting story, because his own background was unique, and through many twists and turns, it always intertwined him with the problem of anti-Semitism and its impact on our world today. Now, just for your information and for your entertainment, if you've ever seen the program Ghost Hunters, they had several episodes about the home of former President James Madison. And I want to tell you something, folks. That estate was owned by DeWest Tucker and his family. Of course, they're not going to mention that on TV because, of course, you can't mention the fact that a notorious anti-Semite owned the home of one of America's great presidents, but yes, indeed, they did. Anyway, West Tucker, born to wealth and privilege, he was a descendant of one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And he later married an heir to the Condé Nast publishing empire. He was a graduate of Cornell and a veteran of World War II. That was a war that he believed then, until his dying day, was a war that need not and should not have been fought. Wes Tucker devoted much of his personal fortune to fighting for the nationalist cause that he never abandoned. In his early years, the floridly handsome hooker was not only a Broadway actor, but also an advertising model appearing in advertisements for Chesterfield cigarettes. And he wore an eye patch in the famous Hathaway shirt advertisements. You probably, if you're old enough, you probably saw his picture. However, Hooker gave up a promising career on the stage after having been offered Henry Fonda's lead role in the road tour of the Broadway hit Command Decision, because Hooker preferred to work behind the scenes in the entertainment industry. Hooker ultimately went to work as a talent agent for the Music Corporation of America, MCA. In the early 1950s, he was one of the highest paid talent agents in America. In fact, he was said to be the highest paid Gentile talent agent in America. His focus was on the burgeoning area of television production. Now, this is what's interesting. All these black-hating, racist people today who kind of proclaim themselves as students of Adolf Hitler, and Adolf Hitler would have shit all over them, ladies and gentlemen. Adolf Hitler would have stomped all over them. Wes Tucker, who was a no-holds-barred advocate of the policies of Adolf Hitler, Adolf Hitler's disciple, Wes Tucker, was proud of his efforts to promote black entertainment for black audiences. He encouraged the artistic endeavors of black singers and actors. At the same time, though, folks, Hooker rejected the concept that black music and black culture should be promoted to white audiences. Now that, of course, is a guiding principle of the multicultural music and motion picture promoters of today. DeWest Hooker would have stomped all over the likes of this race-baiting, race-hating, particularly loathsome individual. Pete Papa Heracles, who is the behind-the-scenes boss collaborating with Elizabeth Cardo, who runs American Free Press today. It's interesting because Hooker was particularly enthusiastic about the increasing prominence in the mid-1980s of Minister Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam. And the truth is that I first met Farrakhan while accompanying Hooker to a by invitation only of the Nation of Islam in Washington, D.C. in 1985. Now, you'll find this interesting. For a period, one of the MCA, that's the Music Corporation of America, one of the MCA corporation contracts under Hooker's domain was that of a former B-movie actor turned television star, Ronald Reagan. But I want to tell you something, folks. That detail is left out of Reagan's official biographies because they don't want to mention the fact that he was connected to that anti-Semite, DeWest Hooker. Now, what's interesting, kind of a secret description of Hooker's relationship with Ronald Reagan's rise to prominence appears in a little-known book entitled The Kingmaker, published in 1972. And that was 8 years before Ronald Reagan reached the presidency. And now that book, The Kingmaker, was written by Henry Denker. He was a well-known New York writer, producer, and director with widespread inside knowledge of the show business industry. That book was a Romanoclé. Now, you probably don't know what that term is, but Romanoclé refers to a so-called fictional novel based on real-life characters and events that are thinly disguised. But everyone knew that that book, The Kingmaker, was about the real-life, behind-the-scenes story of Ronald Reagan's political and financial dealings with the MCA agency. And how those dealings helped bring Reagan to the governorship of California. MCA, of course, referring to the Music Corporation of America, which, of course, DeWest Hooker worked for. See how it gets very circular, folks? Now, that book is not easy to find. And that may well be because of the fact that if you read between the lines, or not even between the lines, you'll discover some unpleasant things about Ronald Reagan and the people, that Jewish super mob who made Reagan into the American political powerhouse of the 20th century. My friend DeWest Hooker was a real-life model for one of the characters in that book, Carl Brewster. In the book, Carl Brewster was a frankly anti-Jewish television industry executive. And, you know, as West Hooker would be the first to tell you, he was unabashedly and frankly anti-Jewish. And he would be the first to admit it, no questions asked. Wes Tucker was a powerfully built man. He was fearless, and he wasn't afraid to make his position known. He threw more than a few punches in his day. In that book, The Kingmaker, Ronald Reagan is presented as Jeff Jefferson. In that book, Jeff Jefferson is a has-been former movie actor who was catapulted into the California governorship through his association with one Dr. Irwin Cohn, C-O-N-E. And that Jewish doctor was the founder of a mob-connected bookmaking agency, the Talent Corporation of America. The Talent Corporation of America. And that TCA emergence as a political force in its own right. Now, unless you figured it out on your own, Dr. Cohn was the real-life Dr. Jules Stern, and that TCA is really the Music Corporation of America, better known as MCA. MCA, that's a subsidiary of the Bronfman Empire. Well, evidently the book was too much on the mark, so much so that Dr. Stein's real-life partner, Lou Wasserman, described the book as, quote-unquote, a piece of garbage, even though Wasserman himself isn't even described in the novel at all. But in 1986, organized crime writer Dan Mulday wrote his own book entitled Dark Victory, Ronald Reagan, MCA and the Mob, and he told essentially the same story that was told in this novel, The Kingmaker. But, needless to say, DeWes Tucker's anti-Semitism didn't go over well with his bosses, Lou Wasserman and Joel Stein. And, of course, naturally, Hooker had a parting of ways with MCA. But, of course, eventually, when Henry Denker wrote the book, The Kingmaker, he did mention our old friend DeWes Tucker, but not by name, although he called him, as I say, Carl Brewster. But you know, Wes Tucker was a smart guy. He was a funny guy, ladies and gentlemen. Great guy. He walked away from MCA, a very rich man, and he was able to outwit the Jewish monopoly to the point that later Jewish show business columnist and ADL shill Walter Winchell described Wes Tucker as the only person who ever outfoxed Lou Wasserman. Now, actually, in personal conversations, Winchell was known to say more candidly that Hooker was the only goy to have accomplished that feat, although Winchell's language was far more guttural in describing what Hooker had done to his former employer, these Jews at MCA. Folks, I'm going to use some Yiddish language. And pardon me for this. Walter Winchell said, now if you have any children listening, please ask them, close their ears up. Walter Winchell, one of the most respected Jewish columnists in America, said the West Hooker was the only goy that ever, and pardon me for this language, he said he was the only goy, and I quote, that ever, quote, unquote, fucked Lou Wasserman. Well, frankly, folks, I have to raise a toast to my old friend, the West Hooker, for that. Sorry if I offended anybody for using that language, but that's the language that was used, and that's what that respected Jewish columnist said about my friend, the West Hooker. Well, during the 1950s, the West Hooker immersed himself in nationalist affairs. And not incidentally, one of Hooker's foremost protégés was, in fact, George Lincoln Rockwell, founder of, I hate to tell you, the American Nazi Party. In his memoirs, This Time the World, Rockwell credits Hooker as being a major influence on his thinking. In fact, Rockwell dedicated the book to Hooker along with Senator Joseph McCarthy and General Douglas MacArthur. Hooker, Rockwell declared, was the one who taught me to know the cunning and evil ways of the enemy. Well, folks, with such intense inside knowledge of the burgeoning television industry under his belt, West Hooker moved towards setting up a fourth television network in the mid-1950s. Now, needless to say, that was much of the distress of the Jewish media elite. Hooker himself candidly admitted that his project was designed to be the first, quote-unquote, West Hooker's words, non-Jewish controlled television network. West wanted the new network to be totally divorced from Jewish money and influence. And not surprisingly, learning of Hooker's project, the Anti-Defamation League devoted a two-page spread in its bulletin in the summer of 1954 to exposing the West Hooker. It was entitled The Case of the Charming Bigot. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the West Hooker was charming. Was he a bigot? Well, the Jews say that he was. That title itself was quite revealing. Even the ADL, so disposed to smearing people and casting aspersions on their character, was forced to acknowledge that Hooker was possessed of an engaging, classically larger-than-life personality that just wouldn't quit. Well, it was in 1956, through the offices of their mutual friend, famed nationalist theoretician Lawrence Dennis, that Hooker was able to arrange a private meeting in Palm Beach, Florida, with retired Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy, father of then-Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts, who was then actively seeking the Democratic Party's vice presidential nomination. Well, after a game of golf, Kennedy and Hooker got down to business. Hooker was there to solicit Kennedy, a former movie mogul himself, for Kennedy's financial, political, and personal backing for Hooker's proposed fourth network, free of Jewish influence. And one of the people who had been supporting West Hooker's efforts was retired General Hugh Johnson, who had been a major critic of U.S. I'm sorry, folks, I made a mistake there. General Robert Wood. I was referring to General Hugh Johnson, who was a major critic of U.S. involvement in World War II, but it was General Robert Wood, who actually later became head of Sears and Roebuck. In fact, he used to claim, I'm told, that he was the only Gentile that ever took a Jewish department store away from the Jews and put it in Gentile hands. But in any case, with the backing of people such as General Robert Wood, Westhooker hoped to interest Joe Kennedy in supporting this proposed fourth network. Well, Hooker made his presentation to the retired ambassador, and Kennedy's response was supportive in spirit. But old Joe made his final position clear during their four-hour conference. And what Kennedy said to Hooker is, in my personal estimation, one of the most revealing and extraordinary things I have ever heard about the reality of Jewish power and the consequences of American involvement in World War II. And this is how Westhooker recalled Joe Kennedy's words. He said, Joe admitted that when he was ambassador to England that he had been pro-Hitler. However, in Kennedy's words, we lost the war. By we, he didn't mean the United States. When Kennedy said we, he meant the non-Jews. Joe Kennedy believed that it was the Jews who had won World War II. Kennedy told Hooker, I've done everything I can to fight the Jewish power over this country. I tried to stop World War II, but I failed. I made all the money I need, and now I'm passing everything I've learned on to my sons. I don't go with the loser, Kennedy told Hooker. I've joined the winners. I'm going to work with the Jews. I'm teaching my boys the whole score, and they're going to work with the Jews. I'm going to make Jack the first Irish Catholic president of the United States, and if it means working with the Jews, so be it. I'm in sympathy with what you're doing, Hooker, Kennedy said, but I'm not going to do anything that will ruin Jack's chances to become president. Well, before the Jews and their supporters start celebrating too much, folks, Kennedy went on further. He said there was a bigger agenda at work. Kennedy told to Westhooker that once the Kennedy family achieved the White House and consolidated their power, they planned toward moving to breaking the back of Jewish power in America. By hitting the Jews where it would truly make a difference in the financial arena. In fact, Kennedy said, the intent was to move against the Federal Reserve banking monopoly. A former banker himself, Kennedy, who was one of the richest men in America, understood money if he understood anything. Now, of course, while today there are those who circulate the false story that while President JFK did move against the Federal Reserve by issuing debt-free U.S. notes outside the Federal Reserve's purview, and that those notes were withdrawn from circulation by Lyndon Johnson immediately after JFK's assassination, that story is just not true. It's actually a combined product of wishful thinking, misinterpretation of actual facts, and an outright refusal to face some historical facts. But then again, that's something, unfortunately, all too often we've seen among so-called patriots, particularly since the advent of the Internet. In fact, folks, the Johnson administration itself released U.S. notes into the American economy in 1966. And that was following a long-standing congressional mandate that had been on the books for some time. And if those of you out there have any doubts, and I know that there are who do, a simple check of currency dealers on the Internet will demonstrate that U.S. notes were indeed introduced into the economy after the Kennedy assassination, during the Johnson administration, and many of them can be purchased online today. Or you don't have to go online to do it. Currency dealers anywhere. Now, I know it hurts a lot of people's feelings to hear that, but that's the truth. You know, the complete and accurate story behind the legend of JFK's greenbacks, which never existed, sad to say, can be found in my book, Final Judgment, in the, I think, the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions. And, you know, while I take no pleasure in throwing a wet blanket on this popular legend, I do remain committed to the facts, no matter how much they may upset so many good people who have placed so much faith in this popular myth. And a myth is what it is. But despite that myth that continues to reverberate to this day, the fact is, as West Hooker had learned, the Kennedy dynasty did indeed have the Federal Reserve System in its gun sights. But you know, there's still more to the story of the meeting between Joe Kennedy and West Hooker. As they were parting, Hooker asked Kennedy if there was anything he could do to help the Kennedy family's agenda. And Kennedy, the old politician that he was, said this. He said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, there is something you can do. I'd like you to use your contacts in the right wing. Have them start publishing articles accusing Jack of being controlled by the Jews, of being a Jewish puppet. This will have the effect of neutralizing Jewish opposition to Jack because of me. The Jews know my views, and naturally they'll assume that Jack is a chip off the old block. If the right wing starts hitting Jack, this will give the Jews second thoughts. At least the little Jews who do the voting." Well, Hooker promised Kennedy that he would do what he could, and being a man of his word, Hooker did influence his right-wing contacts, as Kennedy had asked. And Hooker encouraged his friend, Nazi leader Rockwell, and other right-wingers to smear John F. Kennedy, as his own father had suggested. In fact, as one chronicle then of the 1960 campaign noted, the American Nazi Party helped too by throwing its support to Richard Nixon. "Nazis for Nixon, kikes for Kennedy" was one of its slogans. Well, this, of course, was inspired by JFK's own father and carried out through the good offices of DeWest Hooker and his Nazi friend, although that historian who wrote of it probably had no idea it was indirectly the work of Joe Kennedy. For his part, Hooker always said, "As far as I'm concerned, it was my work that got Johnny Kennedy in the White House." And you know, Hooker's claim was not far off the mark, since American Jewish leaders claimed themselves at the time that it was Jewish support for JFK that gave him his narrow victory over Richard Nixon in the 1960 election. Well, this interesting and revealing episode, as I've said before, is not likely to be memorialized at the John F. Kennedy Library at Harvard or in any friendly biographies of the Kennedy family. However, I would have to say there's no doubt the Jewish elite had a fairly good idea of what was going on behind the scenes. Now, after that long introduction, folks, talking about my good friend, my late friend, West Hooker, of course, it led into that subject that I said we were going to be talking about here. And that is, of course, U.S. involvement in World War II. And really, in many respects, I want to talk about Ambassador Joe Kennedy. He's another of the great anti-Semites. That is, he was an opponent of war. You know, we've heard so much slop about Joe Kennedy, but the truth is his real crime was to oppose the intrigues of the Jewish forces that were trying to embroil the United States in the Second World War. Oh, yes, we hear he was a womanizer. Oh, my God. And he was a bootlegger. Do you know how many people, if I mention Joe Kennedy, they automatically say, "Oh, he was a bootlegger." And they would actually have you believe, I think, or they may perhaps believe, that Joe Kennedy was out there in the mountains of West Virginia or Kentucky distilling whiskey. If there's anything anybody knows about Joe Kennedy, it was that he was a bootlegger. Or that he screwed around on his wife. You know, I mean, this is what people know about Joe Kennedy. Quote-unquote, know about Joe Kennedy. Well, You know, as early as 1935, Joe Kennedy told a friend, "I have four boys, and I don't want them to be killed in a foreign war." Pretty basic statement. I don't know how anyone can argue with that. And with that principle in mind, Kennedy spent the next 6 years working to prevent the United States from becoming embroiled in what became the Second World War. And then, after the war actually erupted, Kennedy worked energetically behind the scenes to stop the war and achieve a negotiated peace that would have saved tens of millions of lives. You know, FDR named Joe Kennedy, this Irish-American, ambassador to Britain. FDR thought that was actually quite hilarious, naming a stalwart Irishman as his ambassador to the court of St. James. Now, FDR respected Kennedy's abilities, but it was largely because Kennedy was known as one of the most influential American Catholic business leaders that the appointment was made in the first place. FDR viewed Kennedy's appointment as a sop to the Catholic vote. They believed that having this Irish Catholic in London would help overcome the resistance to U.S. involvement in Europe from the Catholic voters of the Northeast, who, many of them being Irish, but not all of them, but many of them being Irish, were naturally suspicious of the British and Jewish propaganda that was promoting U.S. involvement in the war in Europe. Little did FDR know that Kennedy would, in fact, emerge as a major thorn in FDR's drive for war. In fact, FDR's son, Jimmy Roosevelt, later remarked that father never dreamed that Joe might put ideology above loyalty. He felt that if a policy disagreement ever arose between them, he would simply shift Kennedy to another job. In fact, because Kennedy was very much a man of principle, it was precisely this reason, as we'll see, that Kennedy, in the end, was unable to bring himself to publicly bring down Franklin Delano Roosevelt and expose his behind-the-scenes maneuvering with British intriguer Winston Churchill that brought America to war. Kennedy was very much his own man, so much so that the Boston Post once said of him that Kennedy's only drawback is that he is too regular to be a politician. His expressed insight into human nature would probably cause a riot on the stump. Now, here's what Joe Kennedy wrote to Senator William Borah from right here in Idaho. Kennedy and Borah was a great nationalist, folks. Here's what Kennedy wrote shortly after becoming ambassador. "The more I see of things here in England, the more convinced I am that we must exert all of our intelligence and effort toward keeping clear of any involvement. As long as I hold my present job, I shall never lose sight of this guiding principle." Now, historian Michael Beschloss has written a book, and it's an excellent book, folks. Yes, he's Jewish. Yes, he's an establishment historian, but it's a good book. Very interesting, well-written, fascinating book. It's entitled Kennedy and Roosevelt. Or maybe it's entitled Roosevelt and Kennedy. To tell you the truth, I can't remember. But at any rate, Michael Beschloss commented about this. "At the outset, therefore, Kennedy's purposes were opposed to those of his patron in the White House. Kennedy was striving to influence the President, the Congress, and his countrymen to bar from American foreign policy the alternative of war." Well, in a draft of a speech that Kennedy sent to the State Department for clearance, Kennedy said, quote, "Perhaps I am not well informed of the terrifically vital forces underlying all this unrest in the world, but for the life of me, I cannot see anything involved which would be remotely considered worth shedding blood for." Well, upon reading the draft of the speech, FDR muttered to his Jewish Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau. The young man needs his wrist slapped rather hard. That goddamned FBR, what a piece of garbage he was, ladies and gentlemen. But despite all of this, Joe Kennedy was unrelenting. He gave an address in which he made it clear that he didn't see a war against Hitler as the great save-all for Western civilization. Here is what Kennedy said. It has long been a theory of mine that it's unproductive for both the democratic and dictator countries to widen the division now existing between them by emphasizing their differences, which are now self-apparent. But there is simply no sense, common or otherwise, in letting these differences grow into unrelenting antagonisms. After all, we have to live together in the same world, whether we like it or not. Now, there was a great furor over Kennedy's speech, but his son Jack, the future president, then a student at Harvard, wrote to his father that, quote, and this is Jack Kennedy saying this, folks, while it seemed to be unpopular with the Jews, etc., was considered to be very good by everyone who wasn't bitterly anti-fascist. Yep, John F. Kennedy commented that the speech seemed to be unpopular with the Jews, etc. Sounds like something an anti-Semite might write. Well, Kennedy himself, that is, the Ambassador Kennedy, actually put forth a plan to transfer tens of thousands of German Jews to the United States and Africa. He hoped to win the support of the American Jewish community and the Roosevelt administration for the effort, but FDR denied any knowledge of it, and the plan never came to fruition. Had Kennedy succeeded, many lives could have been saved on both sides of the European conflict that ultimately involved the United States, because the fact is, yes, folks, we fought World War II to save the Jews. It was a war, as the great British nationalist Arnold Spencer Lee said, a Jewish war of survival. Well, according to Kennedy, there were three options for American foreign policy. One was to pursue Woodrow Wilson's doctrine of making the world safe for democracy by working to overthrow Hitler. The second was the concept of occupying all vital positions within 1,000 miles of American shores. Well, Kennedy rejected these options. The third option was Kennedy's recommendation. He suggested dividing the globe into 4 or 5 independent spheres of influence: the Americas, France and Britain, Germany, Russia, and Japan and China. Each region would support itself politically and economically, but would trade with the others as necessary. Kennedy argued that under this plan, the world would, in his words, settle down to a long peace and security in which the forces for freedom everywhere would once more have an opportunity to develop. Now, bear in mind, folks, that during this period, when Ambassador Kennedy was arguing against the United States getting involved in a war in Europe on the side of England against the Germans, he had become quite a close friend with then-British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. Now, this surprised many people, FDR in particular, who felt that an Irish-American such as Kennedy could never forge such an alliance. However, Kennedy and Chamberlain, despite their ethnic differences, they were devout men of peace and both determined to avoid war with Germany at all costs. In addition, both the Irish-American Kennedy and the English leader Chamberlain felt that Jewish interests were largely responsible for the clamor for war against Hitler. Speaking to his many English friends, who saw no reason for Britain to enter into a war against Germany, and that's part of history that that the Jewish media suppresses as best it can, the fact that there were so many Englishmen and Englishwomen who were opposed to going to war against Hitler. Well, speaking to his English friends, Kennedy actually once described the policies of the Roosevelt administration of being a Jewish production. But Kennedy felt that he had more influence being on the inside rather than fighting FDR from the outside, and he did everything in his power to work for peace. At one point, Herbert von Dirksen, the German ambassador to London, reported back to Berlin on Kennedy's attitude toward Germany in particular. He said, and this is a quote, he said, "Although Kennedy did not know Germany, he had learned from the most varied sources that the present government had done great things for Germany, and that the Germans were satisfied and enjoyed good living conditions. The ambassador then touched upon the Jewish question and stated that it was naturally of great importance to German-American relations. In this connection, it was not so much the fact that we, that is Germany, wanted to get rid of the Jews that was so harmful to us, but rather the loud clamor with which we accompanied this purpose. He himself understood our Jewish policy completely." Now, folks, I know some of you are out there saying, "Aha, that's proof that the Germans wanted to gas the Jews." No, this reference here, folks, they were talking about wanting to get rid of the Jews, that is, get the Jews out of Germany. So don't get too excited over that out there, you folks who are devout believers in the Holocaust, as so many patriots and followers of Alex Jones happen to be. Well, what is not widely known today is that Kennedy himself made an active effort on his own to thwart the drive for war, working to achieve an accord with Germany that could have preserved the peace. In the spring of 1939, Kennedy and James Mooney, the head of General Motors in Germany, put forth the plan to provide a massive American and British gold loan for Germany. After a series of overtures by Kennedy, representatives from Germany came to London and reached an amicable agreement. Germany would receive a $1 billion gold loan, a return of her colonies, and the removal of any restrictions on German trade. In return, the German government would agree to limitations on armaments, non-aggression pacts with its neighbors, and free trade. Kennedy and Mooney had received commitments from major international financiers to provide the money for the loan, and Hitler himself was reportedly pleased with the peace pact. But the Roosevelt administration, ladies and gentlemen, managed to scuttle the deal before it ever went through. Ah, oh, that Roosevelt, ladies and gentlemen, really, what a horrible... He's in the same guttural league as Elizabeth Cardo. Well, you know, when war was thus finally and seemingly unavoidable, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain called his friend Kennedy to his office, and with tears in his eyes, Kennedy read Chamberlain's speech to Parliament. Kennedy then called FDR via transatlantic telephone. According to historian Michael Beschloss, Roosevelt could barely recognize the choked voice from across the Atlantic. Over and over, Kennedy cried, "It's the end of the world, the end of everything." Despite this, folks, Kennedy was still hopeful that the U.S. could avoid entering the war and continued to put forth proposals to prevent it. However, at one juncture, FDR told his aide, Jim Farley, that Kennedy had sent him the silliest message I've ever received. It urged me to do this, that, and the other thing in a frantic sort of way. FDR also told the Jew Henry Morgenthau that Joe has been an appeaser and will always be an appeaser. Returning to the United States for a much-needed rest, Kennedy created quite a stir speaking at a Catholic church in Boston, when he warned the parishioners, "As you love America, don't let anything that comes out of any country in the world make you believe you can make a situation one whit better by getting into the war. There is no place in this fight for us. It's going to be bad enough as it is." Kennedy said he saw no reason, economic, financial, or social, to justify the United States entering the war. This is not our fight. Kennedy pulled no punches. He told the Queen of England to her face that he felt that the United States should assist Great Britain, but not by sending young Americans to fight and die for Britain. While serving in London, Kennedy met famed aviator Charles Lindbergh, and the two took an instant liking to each other. They found themselves in full agreement the United States had no business interfering in a conflict in Europe. For his part, Lindbergh wrote in his diaries of Kennedy, quote, "He's not the usual type of politician or diplomat. His views on the European situation seem intelligent and interesting." Mrs. Lindbergh herself noted that she could barely pull her husband away from Kennedy and concurred that she saw in him an Irish terrier wagging his tail, a very nice Irish terrier. Well, despite his ugly image that prevails in the Jewish-controlled mainstream media today, there were some nice people who clearly thought otherwise about Kennedy. They thought he was a pretty nice guy. Well, with the growing rift between Kennedy and FDR over FDR's war policies, many leading figures in both major parties began to encourage Kennedy to come out publicly and oppose Roosevelt, particularly when it became apparent that FDR was going to make a bid for a third term in 1940. But, you know, Kennedy still, you know, Kennedy, ladies and gentlemen, he still hoped that war could be avoided and that he could play a part in preventing it. He had that much faith in himself, in his power of persuasion. And, you know, he was also still loyal. He said, "I can't go against the guy. He's done more for me than my own kind. If he wants it, I'll be with him." So Kennedy declared his early support for a third term for FDR, and then later formally endorsed the president in the 1940 election. However, as you'll be seeing shortly, folks, there's probably much more to that story than initially meets the eye. And although Kennedy did endorse FDR, he still made clear his ultimate intention of leaving the ambassadorship by the end of 1940. And at the same time, he began to intensify his own effort to counter the drive for war. Now listen to this, folks. Can you imagine this happening today? At a meeting in Hollywood, before a largely Jewish audience of movie executives, and this is a report from an actor of Jewish extraction, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., who rushed to report all of this to the White House. Kennedy said before this audience of largely Jewish movie moguls, he said that groups such as the America First Committee and other groups fighting against the war were, in Kennedy's words, not so far off the mark when they suggest that this country can reconcile itself to whomever wins the war and adjust our trade and lives accordingly. According to Fairbanks, quote-unquote, "Kennedy apparently threw the fear of God into many of our producers and executives by telling them that the Jews were on the spot and they should stop making any Nazi pictures or using the film medium to promote or show sympathy to the cause of the democracies versus the dictators." Fairbanks concluded his report by proclaiming his view that Kennedy had been, quote, "violently influenced by strong Catholic appeasement groups and is in favor of a negotiated peace." Well, Kennedy at this point began meeting with other high-level anti-war figures such as publisher William Randolph Hearst, former President Herbert Hoover, who was far from perfect, by the way, folks, but he did oppose U.S. involvement in World War II, Charles Lindbergh, and others, including Lawrence Dennis, whom I mentioned earlier. However, shortly before, and this is a very interesting story, ladies and gentlemen. This is a very interesting story. Shortly before the 1940 election, Kennedy made a return trip to the United States, and in many quarters it was believed, really hoped, that he would resign as ambassador to England and thoroughly denounce FDR's policies and endorse Republican candidate Wendell Willkie. Well, an endorsement of Wendell Willkie probably wouldn't have been the best bargain in the world, frankly, folks. Wendell Willkie was a son of a bitch. But be that as it may, many people hope that's what Joe Kennedy would do. However, the circumstances surrounding Joe Kennedy's return trip to the United States remain controversial to this day. Kennedy arrived in New York having made plans in advance to first visit his friends Henry and Claire Booth Luce in Manhattan. A newspaper said that Kennedy, quote, looked for all the world like a man bursting with things to say. Yet something unexpected happened, folks. When Kennedy stepped off the gangplank at New York, he was greeted promptly with two messages. A handwritten message from FDR asking him to come to the White House, and a telegram from Senator James Burns of South Carolina advising Kennedy that he should indeed go straight to the White House. Well, an obviously surprised Kennedy immediately phoned the White House in Washington, where FDR was having lunch with House Speaker Sam Rayburn and young Representative Lyndon Johnson. Well, FDR cooed. He cooed to Kennedy and he was dying to talk to him. FDR's words, and he told him to come to the White House. Well, as he did so, the president looked up at his guests and reportedly drew his finger across his throat as though he was about to cut somebody else's. In the meantime, Kennedy told the press, I'm going right to the White House, and I'll talk a lot when I'm finished with that. Kennedy immediately caught a plane to Washington with his wife, Rose, never even letting his friends in Manhattan, Claire and Henry Luce, know of his change of plans. Well, at the White House, Kennedy and his wife were joined by Senator Burns and his wife, and there was a candid discussion of Kennedy's status as ambassador. Now, all the published reports of the meeting, as reported by the participants, were in basic agreement as to what happened. However, now this is where it gets very interesting, folks. Michael Beschloss notes in his book, Kennedy and Roosevelt, perhaps cryptically, quote, the next portion of the dialogue remained a mystery. John F. Kennedy later said that FDR gave his father the impression that FDR would support Ambassador Kennedy for the Democratic nomination, the presidential nomination, in 1944. However, James Roosevelt, the president's son and a close friend of Joe Kennedy, later said he believed that his father had warned Kennedy that abandoning him would do damage to the political careers of the Kennedy boys. However, more ominously, according to Michael Beschloss, others later insisted that the president confronted Kennedy with transcripts of his indiscreet London conversations acquired through British intelligence. According to Beschloss, however, quote, all sources were agreed on the conclusion of the conversation, and that is that after Kennedy and FDR had this obviously somewhat disputed meeting in the White House, the details of which are somewhat disputed, shall we say, Kennedy agreed to give a nationally broadcast radio address in which he endorsed FDR for re-election, and the fact that he did was much to the shock of many people who had great hopes that Kennedy would emerge as an unabashed national spokesman for the burgeoning anti-war movement in America. Well, another Kennedy biographer, Richard Whalen, wrote a great book about Joe Kennedy entitled The Founding Father, folks. He says that undeniably there's a nagging sense of incompleteness about what happened at that meeting, and suggests that there might have been an intervening quid pro quo. However, Whalen rejects the thesis that there was anything suspicious about Kennedy's sudden and apparent about-face. Well, Henry and Claire Booth Luce, according to Michael Beschloss, were astonished by Kennedy's address. These were good friends of his, and she was reportedly his mistress for some time. For some reason, he had failed to warn them of his change of heart and offered little more than a half-hearted apology to Luce a few months later. But Mrs. Luce continued to wonder what had happened that evening at the White House to make Kennedy change his mind. 16 years later, she asked him. Well, Kennedy told Claire Luce, he said, "You just don't refuse a presidential invitation." And then he said, he told Mrs. Luce that FDR agreed that if he endorsed him for president, that he would support his son Joe Jr. for governor of Massachusetts in 1942. Well, so it was, according to Beschloss. Joe Kennedy had finally reached the conclusion that opposing intervention and supporting Franklin Roosevelt were irreconcilable. He now realized that the president's promises to stay out of war had no meaning. That's what he told Herbert Hoover. For being personally loyal to FDR for so long, despite multiple times when he could have single-handedly destroyed FDR, Joe Kennedy, who today we're told was ruthless and mean, realized that he'd been had. Now, Kennedy left his post as ambassador, but he was so relentless in his efforts to oppose the war that in December of 1940 it was reported that Kennedy was still privately working with a group of American businessmen and financiers to arrange a negotiated settlement between Great Britain and Germany to end the war. This, of course, was before the U.S. had yet to become involved. Kennedy's liaison in the effort was a Wall Street figure, Bernard E. Smith. For his own part, Kennedy apparently planned to join two prominent British figures to begin a push in England for a negotiated peace, but the Roosevelt administration sabotaged that plan. So not surprisingly, perhaps, in early 1941, it was reported that the administration was investigating Kennedy's private activities and his tax returns for possible criminal action. So in light of these later subsequent reports that the Roosevelt Justice Department and the FBI were investigating Kennedy's finances and apparently his behind-the-scenes efforts to reach peace with Hitler, it seems quite likely what did happen that day at the White House. FDR presented Kennedy with a deal he couldn't refuse. Although FDR probably did assure Kennedy he would support his son's political ambitions, there was probably more to it than that. FDR most likely told Kennedy, "Play ball or go to jail, Joe." Kennedy actually began to write a memoir of his London years and told Herbert Hoover that the book would, quote, "put an entirely different color on the process of how America got into the war and prove the betrayal of the American people by Franklin D. Roosevelt." But once the United States ultimately entered the war, Kennedy decided against publishing the volume. Even his efforts to volunteer on behalf of the war effort were rejected by FDR, who had no use for Kennedy whatsoever. Kennedy was now determined to put aside his own concerns. He'd failed, and worked toward putting his son, Joseph P. Kennedy, Jr., in the White House. However, now this is interesting, folks. However, young Joe died in an airplane explosion during World War II on a top-level mission. And while today there are many who remember, they say they remember that Kennedy was shot down by the Germans, there's actually much more to the story. On October 4th, 2009, columnist John Kelly, writing in the Washington Post, perhaps inadvertently let the cat out of the bag regarding the circumstances surrounding Joe Kennedy Jr.'s death. It turns out that Joe Jr.'s plane was not shot down by the Germans, like so many people, quote-unquote, remember. Instead, as Kelly pointed out, and I quote, Kennedy's bomber, packed with explosives and rigged to be operated remotely by radio control from a nearby plane, exploded before the Navy pilot could bail out. Kelly cited the book The Navy Cross by a retired Navy captain, Jim Wise, which includes a chapter on young Kennedy. According to Kelly, and I quote, Wise notes that both U.S. and British investigators cited a number of factors that might have caused the explosion. Among them, radio static, a jamming signal, excessive vibration, overheating in the electrical circuitry of the arming panel, and an enemy radio signal. In his book, Wise wrote, quote, one plausible conjecture was that the most powerful jamming station in England went on the air just before the explosion, causing its pulses to affect the remote control system or the arming mechanism in the aircraft. Over the years, of course, folks, there have been more than a few who have suggested that the tragic accident was anything but that, rather that it was outright murder, perhaps carried out at the instigation of FDR and or British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who obviously, under the historical circumstances, also had his own axe to grind with Joe Kennedy. Both FDR and Churchill knew that Joe Jr. was the apple of his father's eye, and that killing the son the ambassador hoped one day to see in the White House would be the greatest strike possible against the hated American nationalist who had sought to foil their war aims. Their war aims, folks, of course, that were being carried out on behalf of international Jewry. I repeat, yes, they were working on behalf of international Jewry. Now, it's entirely possible, quite entirely possible, that young Kennedy's death was a work of intrigue, of intriguers in British intelligence, not necessarily working at Churchill's direct order, or even that Jewish operatives arranged the events that caused the explosion. In any event, and we know this well, the rumors circulating that Kennedy's death was actually murder could not have failed to reach the ambassador, if in fact it was not Kennedy himself who initiated the speculation. Considering all this, it is probably not without meaning that Kennedy was later regularly heard to refer to FDR as that crippled son of a bitch that killed my son Joe. I like that turn of phrase, ladies and gentlemen. FDR was that crippled son of a bitch that killed Ambassador Kennedy's son Joe. Well, folks, as we started off, we can see very clearly that Kennedy's views about the reasons for and the consequences of World War II most definitely did not change as years went by. And considering what ultimately happened in Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963, it thus seems likely that the powers that be had a fairly good idea of what was going on. The Kennedy dynasty was indeed standing up once again to the New World Order, to the International Jewish Imperium. In the end, Joseph Kennedy was flawed, ladies and gentlemen. His greatest attribute was perhaps also his greatest flaw. He was too loyal and too trusting. Otherwise, Ambassador Kennedy might have, even almost single-handedly, been able to stop Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Jews from getting the United States embroiled in the Second World War. Ladies and gentlemen, I will never change my mind. World War II was a war that the United States should not have fought. It was a senseless war. It was, to use Joe Kennedy's words, a Jewish production. Yes, folks, boo-hoo-hoo, it was terrible. It was terrible that Jews were uprooted from their homes, and it was terrible they had to go to concentration camps, and it was a terrible thing that so many Jews died of dysentery and typhus in the concentration camps in Europe. It's a very sad thing. War, as they always say, is hell. I think that's attributed to the infamous William Tecumseh Sherman, who scorched Atlanta. He marched from Atlanta to the sea, as the old song goes. War is hell, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of people died during World War II, and guess what? It wasn't just Jews. Although one would believe that. One would believe that only Jews died during World War II if we pay too much attention to the Jewish-controlled mass media. Oh, yes, incidentally, there were Americans who died. Yes, by the way. And my father and his brothers fought in service to the Jews in World War II. And I think of how my father used to tell me as I was a child, think of your dear old Nina. That's what I called my grandmother, his mother. Think of dear old Nina up here in this big old house all by herself, while all her boys were off in the service. You know how much that scared me as a kid, ladies and gentlemen? Thought of my dear old grandmother up there by herself while her sons were all across the world. Fighting, yes, as I now know, on behalf of the Jews. You know, the easy thing to say is let the Jews fight their own wars, but unfortunately, today in Israel, the Jews, in that gangster state, illegally established on land stolen from the native Christians and Muslims of Palestine, the Jews have a remarkable assembly of nuclear weapons and all sorts of conventional weapons paid for by the tax dollars from the American people, including a poor, fat, old sot like me, who can't even get disability even though I can't walk. My tax dollars pay for that gangster state. Folks, there's something wrong. There is something wrong, and I think you all know that, and I know that. And what is wrong today, you know, as Mark Glenn has rightly pointed out, goes back a long, long time. Well, you people out there who can do something need to do something as best you can to set things right. Hopefully, I'm not going to be around much longer. I don't relish the thought of spending many more years in pain and being unable to walk. And it would be a blessing for me if God were to cause my heart to stop and call me home right now. I know that I'm not going to hell where FDR and so many other people are, where Willis Carto will soon be going, I'm confident. And Elizabeth Carto, too. She's getting up there in years. old fat pink Papa Heracles may have a heart attack and end up having open heart surgery like I did. I think that would be a kick. But folks, as I say, I don't really expect to be around much longer, nor do I want to be around much longer. But those of you who are, you are going to have to continue the fight. I always say God bless America and God bless the world, but I'm going to say that you're going to have to continue the fight to save America and save the world, because if people don't keep up the fight, international Jewry is going to succeed in setting in place that thing that our friend Alex Jones refers to as the New World Order. So, fight to save America, fight to save the world. And to hell with our enemies, because that's where they're going to go. And they're going to burn. But they're going to shovel coal right alongside FDR and Jerry Falwell and, oh, so many other people we could name. Could spend the whole day thinking about it and laughing. Thanks for listening, folks.